InvestorIdeas.com podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of InvestorIdeas.com podcast. In today's podcast, I interview Gary Santo, who is the CEO of Tilt Holdings Incorporated, trading on the OTC as TLLTF and the NEO as TILT, where we discuss some of the company's recent news, their 2022 year, and how this leads into expectations for 2023, what to look for in brand partnerships in the cannabis industry these days, as well as how the U.S. market is developing overall.
Okay, so today I'm talking with Gary Santo, who is the CEO of Tilt Holdings. Gary, it's great to be able to talk to you today. So maybe just for any of the listeners who aren't completely familiar with your background as well as Tilt Holdings, can you just give a brief sort of your background in the industry and sort of what led you to Tilt?
Sure. So Gary Santo, CEO at Tilt. I joined Tilt in mid-2020 at the height of COVID. I had spent some time previously at Columbia Care, which is another multi-state operator, helped take them public. Prior to that, I had a background in finance, in healthcare, life sciences, and casino gaming and equipment. And I think what interested me in cannabis in general is when you think about all those industries they came out of, at least the companies I worked in, there were always companies that were either looking to go public. There was something transformational they were doing. Maybe they were going into an established industry and disrupting it, or they were reinventing themselves, or they were just in new uncharted territory. So when I saw cannabis coming online, I had a friend talk to me. He's like, you've got to get involved. It's the career arc. You've spent all those years coming up through the ranks as the young guy, the brown hair. Now you got the gray hair, and they could use people like you to step in and show how do you take an idea and a passion and turn it into an actual business. And I think a lot of the early movers in the industry leveraged the cannabis kitsch, if you will, with the names of their companies and how they went after stuff. And really, they weren't as, I think, declarative in their intent and their strategy as it was, how can you lose money selling cannabis? And I think what we all found out starting in 2019 is very easily. So to be able to bring that business acumen, that startup mentality and culture, and really an appreciation for the plant and turn it into, you know, a thriving business that can do good things at a lot of different levels, that was the challenge that brought me into the space. And Tilt really was a tremendous platform. You know, I think we are in a number of states, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, and Ohio. We have a partnership in New York. We also have an entire part of the business that doesn't even touch the plant, and that's out in Arizona, Jupiter Research, our hardware division, where we provide batteries and the cartridges for cannabis vaping. And we have a whole R&D lab out there. So we are truly an end-to-end provider on the business-to-business front. We work with brands, we partner with brands, we supply brands and MSOs. And I think it puts us in a very unique position in what is a very crowded market right now.
Absolutely. Glad you touched on a lot of good elements there in that background. I guess I'll just get right into, because I did want to ask about Jupiter Research specifically and sort of how that side of the industry is developing. And are you seeing that continuing to grow, or is that sort of leveled off now? Because I know that when you're looking at sort of the vape industry and let's say next generation cannabis products, there was a lot of hype at the beginning, and you saw as markets sort of onboarded and early markets, that became a big trend. And now you've seen, at least what I've seen, is a little bit of tapering off. Is that been your experience, or how is that developing?
I mean, you could not have thrown much more at the vaping industry than what you did in 2019 into 2020, right? We had the vaping crisis that hit in 2019, which turned out to be, surprise, surprise, if you buy product on the illicit market, you might have problems with it. Certainly the regulated industry really didn't have any issues there. But then as soon as we rolled off of that and you started to see buying habits return, we went right into the COVID pandemic. Now, interestingly enough, it's not that vaporization in some form wasn't still one of the chosen forms of absorption. It's just that when people were no longer having to go into the office, the utility that a vape provides, right? Being able to just step outside the building, take out your all-in-one, perhaps take a quick pull off of that, then go back in the building. You didn't need that anymore if you're working at home. You just step out onto your porch and light up an actual pre-roll and stay with that pre-roll the whole time. And the smell and everything else wasn't an issue to you. So when the utility dropped away, we saw every percentage point that vaping went down, flower use, you know, smokable flower went up. As we now came out of cannabis and people are starting to go back to the workplace, we've seen a return of those all-in-ones. Those are very big in a lot of tourist destinations where you can go and buy adult use, and you know, it's just basically a device that's self-contained. You're not looking to keep it forever. But we've also noticed a change in the consumer in what they're trying to vape. So whereas before you had a lot of those flowery flavors, you had a lot of the fruit flavors and things like that, you saw from people smoking the flower a return to the natural terpenes, the taste, the texture of the draw. So what we've noticed is while traditional distillate continues to be a major part of the vaping industry, we're seeing a movement towards less viscous forms. So the waxes, the butters, the shatters, the hashes, that requires a different kind of technology than maybe what you would use in a higher viscosity vaping. And that's where Jupiter really is at its sweet spot, because I think we're one of the few distributors. We distribute C-Cell, which is basically a ceramic center atomizer wrap with a cotton wick that really revolutionized vaping. Before that, you had a lot of metal atomizers. You had a lot of heavy metals that would break down when you heated it up. And you tended to cook the distillate and the oil, and you'd get that burned taste to it. Well, the much more even heating from the ceramic really changed everything. And that had been a technology really being used in the nicotine field, with which was ironically less viscous. So fast forward to where we are today in 2023, we just rolled out at MJ Biz three new technologies that are leaning now towards things like blending, things like the less viscous forms of vaporization out there, where more natural terpenes are starting to come into play more and more. So it might have slowed down a little bit. I think what you're seeing is it's starting to bifurcate. Those who will stay with the high viscosity distillate, and those then who are going to start to be the offshoots into the more, the less viscous, more pure forms, if you will, that feel a lot more like you're smoking the actual flower.
That's a lot of good insight on that industry, because it is something that I've seen, like I said, slowly evolve over time. And that's good to hear that people are looking for a more natural component of the plant again, because I do think that that's where you're also getting the higher quality product. When it comes to distillate and isolate, there are issues. There are a lot of debates within the industry. With regards to sort of that, I know you guys specifically launched the blend aspect. Is that something you've seen was well received at MJ BizCon, and sort of what was the consumer perception? Because that is a unique product and a unique offering, is the ability to sort of blend your CBD or THC or different forms of concentrates together into a sort of mix.
Yeah, I mean, I think for us, in general, as I walked the floor of MJ Biz, I was surprised by not only how many ancillary businesses are sprouting up attached to cannabis that don't even touch the plant, but then just the number of vape providers, right? So C-Cell, which is a brand, it's a technology that's owned by a company called Smore out of Shenzhen, China. They had the market cornered back in 2017, 2018. The number of competing brands, and whether they're knockoffs or not, and just kind of no-name brands coming from out of nowhere, try this atomizer, try that atomizer, was amazing. But they were all variations on a theme. What I thought was interesting is our Jupiter booth was one of the few out there that talked about innovation being back. So it wasn't like, hey, we're the premier distributor, or hey, we're the this, we're the that. It's the innovation's back. So when people came by and they saw we had three different types of things, two of which were tied to blending. So the Aiden blend pen, which is just basically take two 510 carts and put it into the Aiden device. And then it allows you to draw off both carts together with one power source. But then also our Threads product, which is basically a 510 thread cartridge without a mouthpiece that sits in between the battery and in between the other 510 thread cartridge with the mouthpiece. And just the things you can do by being able to separate the things you blend. So instead of trying to create one all-in distillate or one all-in feature, you can now blend it. And as you think about those less viscous forms of concentrate I talked about earlier, you're not going to be able to blend some of those things together. You're going to have two separate cartridges, if you will, to pull that in. So people were pretty excited. We got a lot of pre-sale interest there. We haven't formally launched into market yet and start taking orders. But we were surprised by how many even big MSOs were coming by and wanting to see, hey, can we get an exclusive on something like that? And that's music to our ears, because I think it had been a while since there was anything that you could argue was really changing the face of vaping.
When it comes to that side of the industry, because I know, for instance, PAX is very well known within the vaporizing community. They've done a lot of exclusive deals with different companies. Is that still kind of the ideal business model for a company like Jupiter Research when you're looking at working in this industry? What's the advantage, I guess, just because I know that the biggest difficulty, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, is brand recognition and awareness. As much as these brands have gone the distance and have managed to sort of stay afloat, there still isn't the sort of same brand recognition, and there really can't be within the cannabis industry as there is within other industries, because of all the different marketing regulations, because of all the different regulations surrounding advertising and sort of how you can promote your brand. So when it comes to the sort of exclusive arrangement, what are the advantages versus just having your product available in retail stores?
I think you do have to be careful on the exclusivity front. There has to be a real reason for it, because now I think from our perspective, whether it's Jupiter or even from our cannabis operations, we're not big into building a brand that is called Jupiter or that is called Commonwealth Alternative Care or Standard Farms. We want to be the shop that provides brands and provides MSOs with the technology, with the brand, with the branded products from our third-party relationships and otherwise. And we're happy to be the engine behind that. So what I mean by that is, if you think about the Curaleaf Select pen, you know it is Cura Select. What you don't realize is that is a Jupiter-provided C-cell device behind the scenes. And we're fine there. We're fine with that, because that gives us multiple shots on net. So as we look to some of the other partnerships we have, and you see that, you know, Heavy Hitters, you know, was using, a C-cell derivative and things like that, we're perfectly fine there. We don't need to have Jupiter out in front. And I think that's kind of the question. When you think about PAX, everybody knows PAX is PAX, right? You don't really know PAX as somebody else's branded product and they're just the engine. And I think it goes back to what we've built the company for. We know it's hard to build a brand in cannabis. It's hard for so many reasons to build a brand in general when you add all the regulatory insanity and inability to cross state lines. And even just the fact that the same product might not be available in two adjoining states, it becomes that much more difficult. So for us, partnering with brands, being the B2B provider to those brands, I think that helps us with our particular strategy. That's what's allowed us to be really the leading C-cell distributor. I think we have about a 50% market share for C-cell. And that means that we've got relationships with over 700 brands, MSOs, and Canadian LPs. But again, you probably don't even know that as Jupiter. You just know it as those particular brands' products.
Yeah, that does seem like it's an easier business model to deal with, just because, as I've said, there's a lot of difficulties. You could, you know, if you get attached to the wrong brand and their name suddenly starts impacting your business, you know, cannabis is still full of negative press. Every day there's still some sort of bullshit that comes out. So I could see that there's a lot of advantages to being the you know, the machine work behind the scenes.
And on the plant touching side, it's really the same story, right? Because there we have partnered with brands. So we're not buying them. We're not becoming a house of brands that we own for that very reason. I don't know who Coke and Pepsi are going to be tomorrow. And I don't know if the hot brand today is still going to be hot tomorrow. Now, we tend to stay away from things like celebrity weed or, you know, brands that don't really have a lot of depth. They're just a first mover, but that's all they are. And once you take that advantage away, they're an also-ran. So we think we've picked the right brands, and we've got some really great partnerships. You look at Old Pal, you look at Heisman, Black Buddha, Her Highness and so on, 1906 and others. And I think we're there. If we guess wrong, we're asset light in that mix. So it just means that, okay, well, we will find another brand that will fit that same product grid that we're looking to fit, and we'll switch to that brand. We're not millions of dollars invested to a brand architecture we have to somehow reinvent. And I think it's just an interesting way to sort of balance all the price compression you see and the wholesale noise you hear about. It's given us sort of the catbird seat.
Absolutely. So that is something I wanted to touch on, was you guys had announced over the last couple of months partnering with a few different brands. Can you maybe talk about what was appealing about those brands from your business perspective? And sort of what are you looking for? You mentioned a few of the things, you know, to avoid, obviously, the sort of celebrity endorsement, hyped brands, which don't often have enough substance or sort of technical skill behind them. Can you talk about the brands you have partnered with recently and sort of what is the big appeal with those brands specifically?
Yeah, so we're up to 9 brands now. And when we take a look at how to select brands, you know, we started this strategy in early 2021. We felt that CPG was where the market was going, and really brands, independent brands that have fought the fight out in California or Colorado or Washington State, if you could survive there and hold on to a market share there, you understand your price point, you understand where you fit in, then you should be able to thrive back here on the East Coast. In fact, we may need to dial back some of the technology you've rolled out, because I would say the cannabis market out in California is probably a little bit more developed from a use perspective than here, right? You think about where all the big trends have started, they've come from the West to the East, not the other way around. So for us, that's how we started. Let's take a look out there. Let's see who's holding market share. So that allowed us to, and I think that's where the Jupiter relationships really helped. We were supplying a number of these brands, or it came across them. So we got to see what their sales looked like, how they were pricing, were they showing price declines? And then as we put together a grid, we don't want to have a lot of overlap, right? When I think about supplying an MSO, again, we don't want to compete with an MSO. We want to supply them. About 30% of their shelf space is dedicated to third-party products that they know they have to carry just to have a full spectrum for their customers. We want to own that 30% of the shelf space, kind of like the Frito-Lay truck. We're going to roll in. We're going to have a lot of different products that you can choose from, different form factors, price points, and quality points, but not a lot of overlap, right? Because there's no point. If everybody's all the same thing, if we're doing a bunch of infused pre-rolls, well, then we're not providing a lot of selection to our customers. And that's what we try to build. So we look at the brands that fit by form factor, fit by price, fit by quality. And then we take a look at that depth of architecture. You know, some brands do multiple form factors. Some, like a 1906, focus on drops that are experiential, which is fantastic. And they own that space, with a capital O. So that's really what our corp dev team does. They go out and they look at those different brands. And now we're at a point where the brands are talking to us. We used to have to do the cold calling. Now everybody wants to, come and work with us, because we do take things differently in terms of how we treat those brands. I'm kind of sunsetting our in-house brands. They're there to sort of pick up the slack if there's a missing form factor or a different price point. But overall, if you're in market with us and you're doing what you're supposed to do, which is own the marketing, own the in-store experiences, we'll take care of the manufacturing, sales, and distribution. Well, then I'm going to allocate my people and my biomass to your product if you're getting the job done. If you're not, I'll allocate it to the other brand that is. But I'm not going to pull it and allocate it to my own brand just because it's the end of the month or the end of the quarter. And that is a big differentiator for a lot of these brands. And if you don't have that wherewithal, if you don't have your marketing sort of buttoned up, if you're not sure how you're going to activate in the market, you might be a little too early stage for us. I think we can do a little bit of that. But overall, we need brands that sort of have been through the battles a little bit.
So you mentioned, pricing is still a big factor. And I've seen lots of discussions on this of how, in certain more established markets, California, Colorado, there's a lot of discussion about how, when's the bottom going to happen for this pricing, and how a lot of, some brands are at least complaining that because of the regulatory costs, licensing costs, et cetera, your just overall operation costs, the pricing is wiping out some of these businesses that are trying to compete in these areas. But at the same time, I've also seen that high price categories have actually started really making an impact in certain markets that are a little bit more established. Where are you seeing, from the brands you work with, as well as your in-house brands, where are you seeing sort of the best price points to be looking at? Is it better to be aiming for sort of that low end bulk product, or is it much better to be aiming for the high quality boutique market, which does seem to be actually growing and slowly building out?
Yeah, I think what you heard in the early days of cannabis was everybody was going for super premium, a high end kind of upper left quadrant. And after a while, you start wondering, how could everybody, is anybody not growing premium flower, right? I mean, that's the question.
Everybody says that, yeah.
Who's going to come out and say, hi, we grow mediocre, may or may not help. No one's going to do that. But I think from that perspective, what we saw really is the economy turn, is there's a whole unserved population that sits in the middle, right? And those are not necessarily your episodic users. Those are not necessarily, there might be a can of curious mixed in there, but the folks who have incorporated cannabis in sort of an everyday part of their lifestyle. And they need reasonably priced product to go along. They're still going to go every now and then for high end, right? But you're not going to buy Johnny Walker Blue every single time. There are times when you're perfectly happy with red or even black. And then once in a while, you might splurge. And I think that's where we started to focus. We look at, I don't want to call them value. I think it's sort of the middle, right, of the price point. And yes, we'll still have, ones at the value side, and we'll have ones at the high end premium. But I think it's that space in the middle I'll call it the moderate space, where you see the Heismans, you see the old pals, you see the Black Buddhas. They're all starting to compete at that level. And I think that's kind of the wide open field. I've heard other MSOs start to say the same thing. So you're starting to see a little bit of good, better, best breakout of products. You know, we saw this in the vaping industry where, you know, Cura Select, for example, right, was the high-end premium one. Well, they've come up with a couple of other lines that meet that middle to lower end of the spectrum too. And the question is, do you have the brands that people care about? And I think what we saw in Massachusetts was, you know, when you have the right product architecture, even though the wholesale and retail prices had been declining in mass, and there's some discussion that maybe they've bottomed out in Massachusetts on at least the wholesale side, our brand and partner products, straight line. You know, because they already knew from the super high competition they had out west, they knew where to price their products. So they came in, didn't have to offer them at a discount, no BOGOs, and they held their price line, which is exactly what we look for, you know, when we're doing these kinds of models.
Yeah, that does seem to be a very solid strategy if you're looking at the long term of this industry. So obviously, I think it's not a big surprise for anyone that 2022, you know, 2021, 2020, there was COVID, a lot of different issues. Even last year, though, markets saw a lot of negative turns. There was a lot of, I'd say, investor hesitation. Now going into 2023, it seems things are looking slightly more optimistic. I know that as far as safe banking and all that, that's pretty much off the table until something dramatic changes. But, you know, it's been, the rug's been pulled out from that one several times now. So I think people who are too optimistic about that might be a little crazy at the moment. But when you are looking into 2023, what are kind of the big things you're hoping will sort of happen for the cannabis industry this year? Or are you expecting that much of a change from the 2022 year?
I think 2023, people are cautiously optimistic. I think a lot of the analysts out there who are predicting growth levels and everything for the industry, if you go back to the beginning of 2022, it was the usual 30% growth. Then you saw it kind of winnowed down to, well, maybe mid-20s, maybe low-20s, maybe high-teens, mid-teens. Where's the bottom? You know, I do think that you still saw some growth. It just, we had gotten so accustomed to ridiculously explosive growth, right? I mean, it was the only industry I ever saw where if you, you know, as an operator, if you had 30% growth in a quarter, oh, you're a laggard. It's like, really? That's not sustainable at the end of the day. You know, I do think that the problem with the investor sentiment more than anything is investor access. You know, it is hard to buy a cannabis stock. Yeah, you can pick it up on the OTC, don't get me wrong. But in terms of bringing in the kind of investors, this is a high growth industry, right? No matter how you slice it, it's a high growth. It's specialty agriculture, specialty manufacturing, and specialty retail all squeezed together into one industry where the regulations differ from state to state. So it's challenging. So you have to have the right kind of an investor base where growth-oriented investors tend to have that 3 to 5 year horizon. They're not the retail investor, right? This is not, and unfortunately, the way this market was launched was it paired up retail investors with a high growth stock and just, you know, boom, off we went to the races. That wasn't sustainable. The amount of capital that was raised was incredible to me. You know, usually you have to prove yourself before you get access to that kind of capital. And so many companies had that because people were trading on emotion and trading on the buzz and not on the fundamentals. So to me, I wish there could be something. And look, I never thought safe banking was going to be it anyhow, but something that allows more normalized investors to step into the space, make it easier to buy. Maybe it's some iteration of safe banking. I don't know. I really, when I saw safe banking fail, I was disappointed. I felt a little like Charlie Brown trying to kick the ball. But at the same time, I knew that the immediate impact was going to be negligible. By the time you work through it, and maybe I'm just jaded from working in finance with Dodd-Frank, you know, by the time you figured out all the different pieces and all the different operators did the whole KYC, you know, with the banks and got through all the regulatory checks, who knows when we would have felt the real effects of that. But I'm hoping we can figure out a way to make it a little bit easier for people to invest and for capital to be raised in this industry, because we need someone other than the big guys to have access for there truly to be some kind of equity in the industry.
Absolutely. Well, I've heard that sentiment, you know, repeated many a time from, I think, everyone in the industry is they're still looking for the way for cannabis to really properly compete as an industry, and it needs access to that capital. Now that you're seeing more markets in the East Coast, obviously where kind of the finance of the US is based out of, are you starting to hear more discussions around how there could be options, maybe not through safe banking specifically, but how that investor segment could get into this industry? Is there more interest in it now because you've seen those markets open up and now people within those areas actually have more access? Or is generally the industry sentiment kind of the same as it's been?
I think some of it's going to depend on the macro environment. You know, we've been in the process of executing on a refinance. And, you know, I'd say over the past year or so, we were out in the market talking to a lot of different investors. And the interest has always been there. I think the price of the stocks in the market right now, the downside risk versus the upside potential is completely inverted, you know, to the point where even people who are saying, yeah, I'm going to keep an eye on it, but you never know. I think there are people there that are really starting to say, wow, I need to get in at some level. And how can I make that happen? I think the competing factor we saw towards the end of last year was that you also had other mainstream markets that did have access to the NYSE and the NASDAQ had similar issues, right? They saw stock price declines. You saw access to capital getting tough. So suddenly you could get yourself a mainstream stock that had the kind of returns that really only cannabis had a year or 2 years ago. I think that eventually starts to change and people start to come back. Do I think that there's any clear pathway? Look, I think that a lot of people who have been kicking the tires and doing the research, you know, you don't send your team out to do a lot of site visits and everything unless you're starting to get serious. And a lot of these institutional investors, there's pathways. You know, we see family offices getting more and more involved where they can afford the resources, you know, to try to purchase, whether it's opening up a Canadian account or maybe buying overseas. I don't see a quick path, to be honest. But, you know, I do think that some people are going to start to look at these prices and start saying it is actually worth my time. I think we need the macro sector to shake out a little more, though.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's something I've also heard sort of discussed many times is that, you know, as much as the cannabis industry was hit, you know, over the last year or so, comparatively to other industries, the impact actually wasn't as dramatic as a lot of people sort of could have insinuated that, you know, when everything's suffering, it's hard to be, as you mentioned, like, where's the 30% growth is the big complaint. It's like, well, we should be pretty happy that we're still all alive and floating, you know, when there's this much inflation and difficulties going on just on a basic level.
That's exactly right. You know, I think our board has been very good about that. And even the investors, when we talk to them, they acknowledge it. You know, you can sit there and say, what's going on with Tilt stock? And, you know, I think from our perspective, unfortunately, the company picked a tough time to do a second act back in 2019 when the original leadership team that took the company public was exited, really, after spending all the money that was raised and really not having a cogent business model laid out. The board took the difficult step. And that was around the time that the first market reset for cannabis occurred, right? You think about May, June of 2019.
Yeah.
So we never got that big run-up that a lot of the other guys had to start from a higher level. But you take a look at where the stock prices are now, and you know it's not a pretty picture for, I mean, there are companies out there with $500 million of revenue, $20 million in EBITDA trading for below a dollar. That just doesn't make any sense.
Well, I mean, it will be there will be some advantages for the people who do stick it out and you know are willing to commit to the long term of this industry. That's still something that I think, you know, it's hard to focus on because there's so many things that happen, you know, quarter to quarter, and, you know, not just in this industry, but in every industry right now, but it's hard to remember that cannabis is still so infant when it comes to being a global industry, which will eventually happen, it seems. It's just going to take, you know, possibly a decade or two, when I think people still anticipate that it should happen next month.
Well, they got used to things that really weren't sustainable, right? So if you were a first mover in Massachusetts and you were one of five people who were, you know, producing flour at size that you could, you know, produce pounds of flour that you could sell at $4,000 a pound in a turkey bag, well, good for you. But that was never sustainable. That was rented space at best, right? So if you didn't build your company anticipating that margins aren't supposed to be that high, I'm not supposed to have 70% margins. You know, it's probably more 30% margins and I need to live there. But you built your entire company on this notion of 60, 70, 80% margins. Well, there's going to be some kind of, you know, there's a reconciliation that's due. And I think you've seen that. You've seen companies now starting to resize, starting to rethink themselves a little bit more, you know, how they're managing themselves. So in a weird way, the fundamentals are being forced in sort of from the back to the front. Instead of having those fundamentals at the outset, which then brought in the investors, which then caused the stock prices to run up, we started with a run on the stock price that caused money to come in, bad operations to somehow be pushed forward, and then kind of went from there. So, you know, it's sort of the maturing of the market, except we're doing it with live stocks in front of everybody.
Yeah, that's a great way to sort of summarize, I think, what a lot of people have seen is it's just the fact that it is just slowly turning into legitimate business that should have always functioned this way. But it's the fact that, yeah, we have a captive audience that's watching every single move all the time, and reporting on it makes it kind of difficult to not seem crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, kind of the industry is stuck in that perpetual reservoir dog, slow motion walk. You know, if we just had a little theme going with us, watching us all walk along the path, you know, that would be perfect.
Absolutely. So one of the other big things that it just got a lot of attention over the last year. I don't personally find that there was as much impact as there, you know, was discussed, but is the Biden administration pushing through for at least more research access? And I just wonder, as a person who's dealing with brands, dealing with technology, and dealing with experts in this industry, is there still a consensus from, you know, whether it's investors or consumers or just people who are maybe not as involved in the industry, that there does need to be a lot more research on this product, on how it functions, on how it can be utilized? Or is there an insanely large body of research that people can go off of already? And sort of have you seen that change at all as, you know, again, this sort of news came out?
Yeah, I mean, you know, coming out of life sciences, I'm very familiar with, you know, the usual clinical development process, right? Phase one, phase two, phase three, and so on. And what's key to that is consistency of the underlying items being tested, right? And I think the problem you had in the early days of testing, you had a lot of flour coming from questionable spaces where the flour itself was somewhat problematic. So then the tests you ran with that flour were somewhat problematic. So you didn't really have, and what were they really testing for? I think this is something psychedelics has taken a leap forward on. They're trying to do those tests. They know it's going to be a very medical product. But I think for the most part, cannabis has always struggled. Do you want to be medical? Do you want to be adult use? Where do we go from there? And then how do the tests line up? Because the biggest challenge I see right now for cannabis and testing is the cost associated with those clinical trials. There's no real IP in cannabis right now, right? So even if you go through the test, okay, what does that mean? What did you just test? You know, typically life sciences, you'd have a good 7 to 10 year run with whatever molecule that you had the patent on that said, okay, I'm going to own the market for 7 to 10 years to justify the developmental expense and the testing expense. And now I'm going to have that before the generics come in. We're kind of starting with generics on day one at the end of the day. I do think as an industry, though, we should embrace it, because the more we can do to show the uses of cannabis to be something other than episodic, it's got an advantage, frankly, that I think alcohol doesn't have. You know, I've never heard anybody say, you know, I'm going to go have a shot of Jack Daniels because, you know, this hurts or that hurts. It's like you don't really do that. I mean, you might do it to take the edge off, but that's about it, right? So I think this is the kind of product that if you discovered it today and you didn't have the 100 years of prohibition and you didn't have the counterculture and all the different stigmas associated, this would be on 2 to 3 shelves in Whole Foods as this miracle thing. We have to have all sorts of iterations of cannabis-derived product. You know, without even breathing heavy, it would be there. And I think that's where it would be nice to see some type of affordable, normalized testing that could go on to let people know that there is more to cannabis than the episodic things we've all heard about. You know, and for those who can take that leap, and maybe it is an industry-wide kind of mandate, you're not going to find one MSO leading the charge per se, but maybe we come together as a group and we all contribute to that because it'll help all of us.
Absolutely. And you mentioned something there that I think has been discussed a lot, which is, you know, the psychedelics play, it's a lot easier to go that route of clinical trials because you can deal with very specific molecules. a lot of those products basically come from lab settings to begin with. And that's kind of where they can stay. Mm-hmm. The medical side of that is, it's easy to understand. It's easy to implement. Very difficult when compared to cannabis, which, as you've said, has kind of more than one directions it can go in. One of the biggest things that I've heard, you know, we still have had almost zero traction on, is hemp as a textile, or hemp as, you know, a potential replacement product for, you know, packaging, for all these other things. That hasn't even really touched, scratched the surface at all. And that's one aspect of cannabis, plus those recreational, plus those are medical. For Tilt specifically, when you see this industry continuing to evolve, there's always been the discussion of eventually, you know, big pharma is just going to come in and sort of collect up a lot of the cannabis IP and divvy it up amongst themselves. Is that still something that you see as a realistic future? Or, you know, is the pharma play obviously just going to be in psychedelics and cannabis is just kind of too difficult to navigate for that? Where do you kind of see cannabis landing when you're looking at the long term?
I mean, if you think about what makes pharma click, what I talked about earlier, access to IP that they can then have a runway on, right? It allows them to own a market, set the price points, right? I mean, I know they have to look at reimbursement levels and things like that, but overall, you know, you create that drug and you want a period of exclusivity. I don't know that cannabis offers that. And I used to see this in life sciences, where not every molecule that comes off patent is suddenly genericized. Because as much as it might have been big for that company, maybe it was a $300 or $400 million opportunity, or even a $1 billion opportunity, to a massive Pfizer, yeah, it's a rounding error. You know, it's not worth it. I don't have the exclusivity, right? I'm not making the same margin. So it might not be worth it. So I don't know that it's a fait accompli that people will come in. They could come into parts of it. You know, could the agro guys help grow? Probably. Do I see retail getting commoditized on the other side? Yeah, I don't think you need as many stores. You know, I've said previously, we have about 275 dispensaries in Massachusetts, you know, either open or licensed. We only have about 400 CVSs. So do you really need that many dispensaries at the end of the day, right? But that space in the middle, right? The specialty manufacturing, maybe the boutique, the craft grow, if you will. I think there'll be a spot for that. And I think, you know, the beverage industry has shown that. We see craft brews have come on strong and held their position. And it doesn't mean that Budweiser has lost its spot. It's just there's a place for both in the market. So I think those companies that can sort of find that niche and see where they want to play, that's for us. We're in that middle space, right? We want to be the white label guy behind everybody so that, you know, there is a reason for us to exist. Could we get gobbled up by someone? Sure, we always could. But, you know, I think those folks that focus on that part of the equation put themselves in the best position for success long term.
Absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned sort of the craft beer side, because that's what I've personally seen as each market develops. You know, California, Colorado are good examples of that. Of there literally are craft brewers who are partnering with cannabis companies to make craft cannabis beverages. And to me, that it just makes sense that this industry would eventually turn into a model similar to that, is having, again, sort of these micro growers, or however you want to term them, you know, working with a house of brands similar to what Budweiser has done. You know, they have dozens of craft brewers working under them or within their ecosystem, and that doesn't affect Budweiser whatsoever. And I do think that that model looks the best for how cannabis could evolve. So it's good to hear that you guys are positioning yourself for that, because I do think that that's the most realistic version of how this plays out.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And then how the form factors play out, really, you know, there comes a point where you get market saturation, right? How many infused pre-rolls do you need? How many hazy IPAs do you need? You know, it's like one of those kinds of things. So you know, I think that's why staying smart at looking at the use case. And I think that's something that really the East Coast is bringing to bear more and more. I think the product development and the innovation coming out of California is, you know, beyond compare. But I think how those products are then promulgating themselves, it's a different demographic, right? I think you go West Coast, you're talking what, a male probably in his late 20s, early 30s, flat brim, very episodic, price and potency still matter. You come East and price and potency matter, but use cases matter more. You know, I think you see a different demographic. It's female, you know, all, you know, more, you know, female in her 40s. you know, maybe even early 50s, looking for a specific result, which is why you see things like 1906 drops, which are, you know, experiential taking place, and Black Buddha with experiential. Then you see lifestyle like Old Pal and things like that. So it's a bit of a mix. It's interesting.
That's great that you do have, you know, feet in different pools, because I do think that there are huge differences between how all these markets function and the consumer demographics that are involved in all of them. And that is something that I've, again, heard from a lot of different industry reports, is that women, you know, 40 and up is a market that has still been very much underserved and is now starting to come in full force into lots of areas, not just, you know, in the East Coast, but in Canada. Mm-hmm. It's a big part of sales. And again, even some of those established markets, you're starting to know that it's a demographic that can't be ignored and is underserved. And there's a lot of opportunity there.
It is. It's the maturation, right? I mean, you can't always be episodic. You don't go into Total Wine and Liquors every time and walk up to the person behind the counter and say, I am looking to get wasted tonight. Can you direct me to what the best thing to buy is? You know, at some point you go to the wine section and you start caring about the flavor. You start caring about where it came from, how it was curated. And I think that's what we're seeing happen more and more. People are going from kind of curious to being a little bit more, you know, open-minded about use cases and everything else. So it's, the stigma's coming off. There's no doubt the stigma's coming off. And I think many in the industry deserve a lot of credit for that. You know, so you're not just going in quietly, hoping no one sees you go into the dispensary and give me a brown bag on the way out. I think people are being a little more, you know, out in the open about it, which is great. It's needed. It's necessary.
Absolutely. It's been a slow trudge, but it's getting there.
Yep.
So I guess just in final thoughts, is there anything that people should be looking for from Tilt Holdings that you can kind of mention for this year? What's sort of the big goals that are on the horizon?
Yeah, I think from our perspective, you know, we're finishing up our refinance. We had some legacy debt that we started last year with. You know, we've refinanced about half of that so far. We're going to finish the rest of that before the end of this first quarter. And really for us, you know, it's continuing to move forward. So we have those 9 brands that are signed. We signed a lot of them towards the end of last year. So getting them fully activated and deep in our markets is going to be important. Getting that New York dispensary opened up and cultivation and manufacturing, our partnership with the Shinnecock out in East Hampton, Long Island. I would love to get that done before the summer months, obviously. That's when things are the best out in the Hamptons. So I think getting that open and getting those brands that we work with into that New York market will be a lot of fun. And then I think the other piece is just, you know, look for us to be opportunistic. I think we know that with SAFE Banking failing, there's some companies out there that probably shouldn't be public companies. Maybe they don't have a big enough footprint. Maybe they're a single state operator. Who knows? Too small to really hit the radar screen to the big guys, but probably not big enough to make it on their own. I think there's opportunities for companies our size with a clean balance sheet like we'll have to really step in and be opportunistic and, you know, get some tuck-ins here and there and expand the footprint. Because I think the more we can do to expand our footprint and have more, you know, cannabis operations on top of the hardware operations, that's what makes it really exciting. I mean, not to say we're not going to be doing stuff on hardware. We're going to continue R&D and development. We love the kind of reception we got at MJ Biz in October with 3 new pieces of innovation. So I've challenged the team to come up with another 3 for this coming MJ Biz the end of the year. So we'll see how that pans out. But yeah, I think for us, it's just continuing to sweat the assets we have and opportunistically find some tuck-ins to expand.
Well, it sounds like your company is going to have a very clean and effective start to the year. So I hope that it stays that way. And hopefully this industry has a little bit of a bounce back as, you know, things in other industries also move in a better direction. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Taylor. It's a pleasure.
Once again, that was Gary Santo, the CEO of Tilt Holdings Incorporated, trading on the OTC as TLLTF and the NEO as TILT. To find out more information about Tilt Holdings Incorporated, you can click the links attached in the article, or you can visit their website directly at tiltholdings.com. That's all for today's podcast. Enjoy the rest of your day.
That's all for today's podcast. Podcast is now a certified word trademark on the blockchain through Cognate Incorporated CM certification. InvestorIdeas.com podcasts are also available on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play Music, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and TuneIn. If you'd like to be a guest or sponsor of this podcast, please contact InvestorIdeas.com. InvestorIdeas reminds all listeners to read our disclaimers and disclosures on the InvestorIdeas.com website, and this podcast is not an endorsement to buy products or services or securities. Investors are reminded that all investments involve risk and possible loss of investment. Investor Ideas does not condone the use of cannabis except where permissible by law. Our site does not possess, distribute, or sell cannabis products.